Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. Meditation is linked to a lower cardiovascular risk. They looked at 61,000 people, and the study points to some very important heart benefits from meditation. This was done at the Veterans Affairs Research at Baylor University and at Mount Sinai. Considering how poorly veterans have fared financially and with their careers, post the trauma of fighting in conflicts around the world, it's important that we can do something to help them. And if meditation, which is inexpensive and easy to do, can help them, that's just one more thing that allows their lives to be a little brighter, a little more positive. Also today, along with all the latest on health and healing, we'll be sharing some commentaries, and I'd like for you to call in and share your points of view. We have Matt Taibbi, and he'll be responding to critics why the left and the media, which is predominantly the left, has lost its mind after protest. Those are his comments. But he'll show you the rationalization of why would I play this? Why is this important? Look at the bigger picture. You see, we're so focused upon the urgencies of our day-to-day lives. We'll have a job or not have a job. We get extended another $350 a week for unemployment. What are we going to do? Another 1.5 million Americans are unemployed. There was only 4 million brought back in the whole month of June. Well, that means that there's at least 30 million Americans, minimally, who don't have work. Whole industry is adversely affected. And this is just the beginning, by the way. This will have a rolling effect upon all brick and mortar stores, and the next big wave will hit malls. So we're in for a big hurt. So who's behind this? Is it just circumstances? Episodic disasters? That's part of it. But there's a political agenda behind this as well. And I intend to, wherever possible, expose it. And what's happening is that we've gone to such an extreme in censoring freedom of speech and not wanting to hear others' ideas and not wanting solutions where they're profiting from the problems, whole industries. The worse it becomes, the better they function. And that, for example, the hospital associations. Why? Because people are not getting their procedures. If they're not getting procedures, the insurance companies are saving the money they have to give the hospitals. In fact, one of the largest payouts as far as profits, $6.6 billion in just this quarter to United Health. That's one of the reasons we should have universal health care, but without the profit baked into it. That's the problem of those on the left. They're not looking at how, maybe it's unintentional, maybe it's they're just unfortunately stupid, which I believe they are. They're all engrossed in every day, what can I do to get in front of a camera, to get my name back out there, to get reelected. But they're not looking at how do you actually solve a problem. And therefore, you have to really be very methodical. We could have universal health care. If you go to prn.fm and look under the articles, I've laid it all out. We could save almost $2 trillion a year, and at the same time, every single American who chose universal health care could have it. You eliminate the insurance industry and the bureaucracy of that, which would save $1.1 trillion. So you see, we have solutions, and they're positive, but what if other people are profiting from the problem and no solution? So in any case, what we're going to do is we're going to show you a lot of positive, empowering solutions. And so I'm going to play Matt Taibbi because we need to know that the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN, these are no longer reliable sources of information. They are the problem. They're nothing more than well-paid mouthpieces for the establishment. And why we shouldn't engage in this feeling sorry for themselves culture, this self-pitying culture, this victimization culture. It leads nowhere but into apathy and violence. Also, talking about violence, I believe everyone in this audience supports non-violent demonstrations to help see things change, whether it's right now racism, where it exists, and it does not exist everywhere. And yet, think of it this way. Think if all you talked about every day was microaggressions and being a victim and racism, but that's all you could see in every conversation. So every single person you spoke to, especially if they're a white person or Caucasian, you would deem that person inherently racist. That's, by the way, that's a new, whole new thesis that's going around based upon this White Fragility best-selling book, and now it's being taught in school, so children are being taught this. What do you think the outcome is going to be? What about all the decent and loving and non-biased and non-prejudiced people, which are the vast majority, who've been living for decades, almost 60 years, in peace and tranquility and conciliation with other people, going to work, having friends, as marriages, and they wipe all that away like, no, everyone now is the enemy, and then you start to demonize them. Remember, once you change a person from being considered sacred, you can do anything you want to them. That's how, throughout history, for example, the Catholic Church committed genocide in the Americas and other places, but in the Americas, and the toll, we don't have an actual figure. The best projections we have are somewhere between the low, low end of 10 million, the high end of 100 million indigenous people, the Native Americans, were killed from syphilis and smallpox, but also from displacement, etc. You couldn't do that unless you had a class-based society. And the class is what rules. Race and other factors are secondary. That's why, for example, you would not have the founding fathers, many who were adamant against slavery, others supported slavery. And let's just say, for example, John Adams, second president of the United States, and in my opinion, most intellectual, dwarfing that of Jefferson. And by the way, he and Jefferson communicated with each other by letter almost weekly, and they almost died at the same day. In any case, what if Adams said, I believe that we should start by having slaves, by having your families become slaves, all the founding fathers. What would you think would have been the response? Of course, they would have rejected it. What, for example, do you think would be the response if the New York police said, we are going to curtail, radically curtail, our search and seizure. We're going to not any longer stop people of color by profiling them and asking them to empty out their pockets and purses and everything else, but instead we're only going to stop wealthy people. And by some metric system of artificial intelligence, by the way, which is not far off, wait till you hear the program I have coming up where they're combining artificial intelligence by being able to unlock every single electronic device you have. They can go on that little watch that you wear when you exercise, and they can tell everything about the metrics of your health. They can get your fingerprint off your own keyboard now. You can't believe what this secret agency that you've never heard of, that I'm going to be exploring in depth, has been doing for 60 years. In any case, but let's just say that they said, based upon class, we're only targeting the wealthiest class. You must be worth $1 million and above. How do you think that would go down? It wouldn't. That's not based upon race. That's based upon class. So when we see who's invited to the party, now you have two African Americans. One has a PhD from Harvard or Yale or Stanford, Condoleezza Rice. Or one's a 4 or 5-star general, Colin Powell. And they're selected to be Secretary of State, both, and then the chief of the security oversight, Condoleezza Rice. Was that based upon race or class, standing within a particular group? and it becomes irrelevant which group it is. Now, if it was just about class, what if they chose not to bring anyone who was poor and uneducated in that given field? And by the way, none of these people were educated in the field that they later were hired and given a powerful position. Rarely is that ever the case. So you see, we're missing the whole idea of class, and yet we all live by class. I remember once going for a run in Beverly Hills. A friend of mine, who's a producer, lived out there, and we were friends for 25 years. I mean, real close friends, wonderful buddy. I couldn't have asked for a nicer friend. Very humble, very easygoing, very cooperative. He loved to help people. He was a gentle man. He was an Eagle Scout, too. We go camping, and that was so much fun. And so one day, as I did every day when I was out there, I would run down from up on the mountain in Beverly Hills, and I'd run down to a park where there was a track, and I'd work out on the track. And one day I saw a cop car stop a person of color. He was a Mexican-American, and I stood there. I wanted to hear this. I wanted to say why they were. And they were asking him for identification and what are you doing. He said, I work as a gardener here. And after they look at his ID, and then they gave it back his ID, and they said, okay. So I walked over to the cop car, and I said, fellas, I said, why are you stopping him? Well, he doesn't belong here. He works here. He's a human being. I said, so you judged him? But you didn't stop me. You didn't stop any of these other people. Well, they all belong here, meaning we belong to a class, a more affluent class, a more successful class. Now, there are rare occasions when someone who is from a upper position gets challenged. That's happened. Remember the guy, the professor at Harvard? And suddenly that's headline news, because you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to say, because of my class, you should not consider my race as a factor in profiling me, as if it's class that protects you. Because I didn't see the people who got to a certain position in life being treated as others would. And then I have to ask other questions. That leads, opens other doors. What are these individuals doing on a regular basis to help those in their race, but who are at a lower level in income or success? Are they building schools? Are they rehabilitating abandoned buildings for those in the neighborhood? Are they creating jobs? What are they doing across the board? So I decided to do some research and look up how many successful people there are based upon race. It's staggering how many tens of millions of very successful, highly educated, and wealthy people there are across all lines. Those are not the people who are targeted. So what if we suddenly added to the mix of equation class? Now, all the people in Council on Foreign Relations, they're in a class, a unique political class. And what about the neocons in Washington, a unique cultural class? Those in New England, those in any country. You have your royal class, you have your mercantile class, you have your nobility class, you have your professional class of scientists, engineers, teachers, you have your trade class. Carpenters, electricians, masons, plumbers, gilders, and then you have your working class, then you have your what we consider lower working class. Those are generally uneducated people. So when we go to judge someone, what are we judging them for? Their position on a curve, on a spectrum of where they've been able to go in their education or career or life? Or achievements? How do we measure someone? So until we stop for a moment and have a collective exhale and get rid of a lot of the anger and vitriol and start to ask ourselves, why are we fighting each other? Why? What is the likely outcome? Action, reaction, action, reaction. That leads to a cultural war. We don't need it and we shouldn't have it, but there are people who profit from that. Just remember, ask yourself, who profits from many of the staged events that we see that could not be spontaneous? And who benefits from those that seem chaotic and anarchistic? And you think, oh, it's just spontaneous. Sometimes it is, more often than it's not. And why don't we ever pay attention to the people of color and the lower or working class who spent their whole life working in a neighborhood from where they live and originate to build a barber shop or a dress store or a restaurant or a beauty parlor or a bakery? And they have been a part of that community, a constructive part of the community. And they put their kids through school and tried to see that their kids get a start in life without being indebted. But they know what it's like to go to work at 6 in the morning, come back at 6 at night, put in 12-hour days, 6 days a week. And yet, why are we never interviewing them in the news to see what it's like when a peaceful demonstration goes sideways and their stores are destroyed and they're beaten up? Why is their story not important in the media? That tells me that is a red flag, friends. Because if you want to focus upon what are we doing to protect the small business people, what are we doing to protect the neighborhoods, what are we doing to stop the shootings in Chicago that now acts more like Beirut in the 1980s, where there was no safe place to walk? But we're not. And we're not doing something for intent. And we're not covering certain stories for intent. So I'm simply saying, look at the deeper picture. Anyhow, we'll finish up with the health real quick here. So the more you meditate, the lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. That's important. That was published in the American Journal of Cardiology. So try to find once or twice a day for about 10 to 20 minutes just to do, relax yourself, be present with the environment you're in, breathe deeply, and just focus upon calmness. Because with a calm mind, with a non-judgmental mind, you become aware of everything. And that's what you want. From Ben Gurion University in Israel comes a study. This was a double-blind, randomized dose-response study. That the more tomato nutrients you consume, the less high blood pressure you have. So tomato juice, eating tomatoes, tomato sauces, you're getting lycopene, and it doesn't take much, 15 milligrams. You could get 15 milligrams in, you know, tomato soup, bowl tomato soup. This was published in the Peer Review Journal of Nutrients. So the carotenoids, the natural pigments, what's responsible for the bright red skin in a number of fruits and vegetables, but that lowers your blood pressure. And that is important, because we have an epidemic of high blood pressure. And also, I had, down at the anti-aging retreat, I have my own little refrigerator, and because my nutrients are different, and I don't want someone saying, oh, well, if Gary's taking that, I better take that. No, those are specific. I've designed those for my own body. But one of the jars I had sitting out was royal jelly, raw royal jelly. So a person said, why do you take that? And I said, well, because it is rich in enzymes and it's a vitalism. What's vitalism? Well, vitalism comes from the vitalist movement, which showed that when you take in something that still has energy, and that energy is a positive energy, it can help rebalance as an adaptogenic nutrient, much like ginseng is adaptogenic. And black cumin seed oil is adaptogenic. It can rebalance and harmonize the specific frequencies of your cells' vibrations. Meditation can do that. Deep breathing can do that. Sound, if it's a subtle sound, if it's a light sound, sound can do that. That's why a mother's lullaby will put a baby to sleep. But also, how you touch a dog or a cat can put them to sleep and they'll start to purr. Because you're harmonizing the frequency of an energy. So I said, so royal jelly is one of nature's most perfect harmonizing nutrients to take in. And it's what the queen bee consumes. And being a beekeeper for, wow, since 1972. In fact, someone actually contacted me about a year ago. They had come up to the Fertiller Farm in 1972, and they were so happy to be there. They came back three times during that summer, they said, which was not uncommon. We had none of the comforts, no hot water. It was old and rustic, but it was so much fun. The energy was so good. We'd play volleyball and go for runs in the morning on the roads and the mountains, have wonderful meals, cooking classes, tofu making classes, meditation and yoga, and sit around a big campfire at night. So what we lacked in some creature comforts, we made up in just the human energy vibration. But I did a class one day on bees, and I just had on my running shorts. And so I went over the hive, and I'm going to show them how you extract honey from a hive. And so it was funny because one of my friends, Susan Clemens, was there, and her husband was with her. And both couldn't ask for a nicer couple. He's very linear, right? Very linear. In fact, he's the only one I've ever known in my life to get stung by bee. I must have 20,000 bees on me. In fact, it was funny. People were taking pictures. I had bees all over me. And I said, these bees are harmonized. They're not here to sting me. And so I did a whole class with all these bees. And in fact, the bees wait. They know exactly what time you're coming out. In fact, in the wintertime, when there's nothing that they can, there's no nectar for them. And that's why so many colonies collapse. You should always have raw honey, about 1 pound per hive. And you put it up on like an 8-foot stick, and you grease the stick so that other creatures can't climb up there and get their honey. And then you screw into a metal plate that's on top of that pole, and then you take a paper plate, and you put that up on top in the morning, you pour your honey into it. And what's of interest is when I go out every morning in the winter to do this, you won't see a bee. They're all there, thousands of them. And then I put the honey in, and I get down, suddenly it's covered within 10 seconds, covered. They know exactly what time they're there every morning to get their honey. You just have to be harmonized and open, and everything communicates with you, including nature. So this is from Fujian Agricultural University in China, published in the British Medical Journal, investigating the wound healing properties of royal jelly. So the Chinese researchers explored the wound healing activity. Now, you know the bee propolis is one of the best things in the world for wounds, and all over the Americas, Native Americans would use royal jelly and put it into wounds, and also bee propolis, which has natural antibiotic properties. So here they did it, and it worked. And especially with chronic wounds or skin injuries, they become a considerable challenge due to the increasing morbidity of diseases like diabetes and metabolic disorders, where people's skin have more problems. So royal jelly has a lot of properties that are good, especially for wounds, cuts. And you just clean out with hydrogen peroxide the wound, and you take some royal jelly, and you wipe it across the wound gently. Then I would also spray it a little with colloidal silver before. And you could use Manuka honey as well. Just latest thing on something that's right there, royal jelly. Can improve wound closure. It induces a cellular proliferation and migration via the MRJPs, and as such, these proteins may prove useful for the development of natural wound healing medications. That's the latest on health and healing. More to come tomorrow. Why are memories attached to emotions so strong? This is from Columbia University. Memories linked with strong emotions often become seared in the brain. Now, think of the first time as a kid, if you were, let's say, a little boy, and you went to school and there was a bully, and they wanted to meet you outside after school, or they cause you some grief, cause fear. That sears into the memory. But what about the first time you went out on a date and you were excited, didn't know what to do, felt you were probably doing everything wrong from having bad breath to a pimple showing when you were a teenager. These sear into our brain. That's why some of the music that was playing at that time is what we will remember and appreciate later in life, because the music brings back some of the remarkable moments, either positive or negative. But here's where it gets interesting. What happens is that we don't have a lot of brain power. We only need to remember what's important for our future well-being. This is according to the head of psychiatry, Rene Hinn, professor of psychiatry and neuroscience at Columbia University. So fear, in this context, is not just a momentary feeling, but a learning experience critical to our survival. When a new situation makes us fearful, the brain records the details in our neurons to help us avoid similar situations in the future or use appropriate caution. What's still a mystery is why these memories recorded by the brain's hippocampus become so strong. So they did this research. Well, having worked around animals my entire adult life, from primates, I've learned a lot. In fact, the very first primate I worked with back in 1967 was Kokomo Jr. Now, for those who are baby boomers, you may remember Dave Garraway on the old morning show on NBC would have Kokomo Jr. on. Now, the owner of Kokomo Jr. Was my neighbor. We lived on half a block apart up on 89th and Weston Avenue. And there was a trade-off. I would help him get into shape and stop smoking. And in return, I'm going to spend some time with his little chimpanzee. Now, he kept a device on her back. It looked like a little frisbee, but it was metal. And if she acted out in any way, he would hit a buzz and it would give her a little sting. I thought it was inhumane. He says, no. You know, primates, like a tiger or a lion, you never know when they're going to turn on you. But he went on vacation about 3 months later for a week, and I was left to take care of Kokomo. And it was interesting because the first thing I did was I took it off her back. And then I let her out of her enclosure. And she first didn't know what to do, and so I started working with her on sign language. And I would hold her hands, and then in about, I'd say 2 or 3 days, I could give her hugs. And then she looked forward every day to getting hugs and holding hands. And over the next several years, she learned over 160 different signs. She was so good at what she was learning. I wrote a book about it called From Instinct to Intellect, The Study of Primates. When he got back, he went to put this back on her back, and she freaked out because she was loved and appreciated without it, and now he was going back to that kind of strong-willed alpha male, I'm going to do this. And we had a long discussion about it. And he was just angry at the fact that you can't trust. And I says, you can, but you're putting in her mind fear. So when she sees you, she fears you. When she sees that device, she becomes hyper-fearful. And so the memory of that device is always there. Take it away, and you create new memories. So think of now us as human beings. How many times have we been yelled at or demeaned or denigrated, and we were not in a capacity to, you know, argue back, so we just absorbed it. Those memories we remember. When we're humiliated, betrayed, lied to, in any way made to suffer by some bully or some authority figure, we don't forget that. So that's one of the things we learn, and we stick with those. But less significant things, we don't. But if you want something to allow you to survive, you'll remember that. That sears into our memory. And in nature, they'll know which berries are poisonous and which are not, which herbs to use and which you don't. But we have forgotten how close we are to some of the other creatures in this world about using our memory of what we should fear, rightly so, because it allows us to survive. But we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to play you a short clip. I thought it would be of interest to you. And then if you have your comments, I'd like to hear them. We're going to play the when victimhood leads to genocide. Now, mind you, pull back and listen to everything that Professor Jordan Peterson has to say. Agree or disagree, because there are things I disagree with Jordan Peterson on and things I agree with him. But he is one of the true intellects, and he's open. He's not afraid to discuss issues in his classes and with others and debate them. He's done a lot of debating, and almost always people go to attack him because he challenges some of the so-called woke culture and all these artificial designations that are not real, that now we want to believe are real. And they're not. And thank goodness there are people standing up and challenging him. He's one. But look at where something can go, and that's the message. Look at where something can go when you cannot put the legitimacy of victimization into a constructive dialogue to see what is a nonviolent way of resolving an issue. Back in a moment.
One of the things that Maya and I found when we were writing this paper, we were looking at the discourse that precedes genocide in genocidal states, and the enhancement of a sense of victimization on the part of one of the groups, usually the group that's going to commit the genocide. First of all, their sense of being victims is much heightened by the demagogues who are trying to stir up this sort of hatred. So they basically say, look, you've been oppressed in a variety of ways, and these are the people who did it, and they're not going to stop doing it, and this time we're going to get them before they get us. It's something like that. And so there's something very pathological about the enhancement of victimization, which is, well, see, that the problem, as far as I'm concerned with it, is it's not thought through very well. Because there's a point that's being made, and the point is that people have been oppressed and they suffer. And that's true, that point. But then the proper framework from within which to interpret that, I believe, is that that's characteristic of life. You can't take it personally in some sense. And you can't divide the world neatly into perpetrators and victims. And you certainly can't divide the world neatly into perpetrators and victims and then assume that you're only in the victim class and then assume that that gives you certain, like, access to certain forms of redress, let's say. It gets dangerous very rapidly if you do that sort of thing. So, for example, one of the things that characterized the Soviet Union, and this was particularly true in the 1920s, but afterwards, so the Soviets were very much enamored of the idea of class guilt. So, for example, although it was only about 40 years previously that the serfs had been emancipated, they weren't much more than slaves, right? And so that was the bulk of the Russian population. They were bought and sold along with the land. So they had been emancipated, and some of them, many of them, had turned into independent farmers, and some of them had become reasonably prosperous because, at least in principle, I presume a certain proportion of them from being crooked, but I presume a larger proportion from actually being able to raise food. And of course, at that time, the bulk of the Russian food population was produced by these relatively successful peasant farmers. And relatively successful would mean maybe they had a brick house or something, and maybe they had a couple of cows, and maybe they were able to hire a few people. And so, you know, it wasn't like they were massive landowners or anything. But I've talked to you a little bit about the Pareto principle and the notion that in any domain of activity, a small proportion of people end up producing most of what's in that domain of activity. The same was true in Russia with regards to these peasant farmers. Some of them were extraordinarily efficient, and they produced most of Russia's food. When the communists came in, they described those landholders as parasites, essentially, predicated on the Marxist idea that if someone had extracted profit from an enterprise, that they had basically stolen that profit from the people, say, that they had employed or otherwise oppressed. And so you could be a member of the kulak, K-U-L-A-C-A-K, K-U-L-A-K, you could be a member of the kulak class. And then because you were a member of that class, you were automatically guilty. And so what happened was, and you got to think this through to really understand what happened. So what happened was the intellectual communists were sent out in cadres out into these little towns to find people who would help them round up the kulaks. Now you got to think about what a small town is like, because So imagine you're in a town and there's three or four people, or maybe 10 people or something like that, who are a little more successful than everyone else. And a certain number of people are going to be fine with that and maybe even happy about it, because they regard those people as particularly productive and, you know, as stalwart members of the community, regardless of their flaws. But there's going to be some people who are not happy about it at all, that are going to be very resentful about that and jealous. And so those are going to be people whose characters, I would say, are of the less positive type. And so when the intellectuals came in and described the reason that these people should be treated as parasites and profiteers, then it was the resentful minority in those towns, and that would be the kind of guy that hangs around in the bar all the time and is completely unconscientious and fails at everything and then blames everyone else for it. The intellectuals came in and said, this is unfair that this happened to you. You've actually been victimized, and now it's your opportunity to go have your revenge. And so that's exactly what happened. Now, in some of the villages, sometimes the peasants would actually surround the farmsteads of these more successful people and try to defend them, but that never worked out for very long. And so then these angry mobs would go into the farmhouses and strip the place right down to nothing. And they packed these people up and sent them on trains with no food out to Siberia, where there was no place to live. And so that they were packed into houses, you know, maybe they had a square meter each to live in, and all their children died of typhoid, and many of them froze to death. Many, many people died. Millions of people died as a consequence of the de-kulakization, at least in as a consequence of its total effect. So what happened then was that there wasn't any food produced. And so then 6 million Ukrainians starved to death in the 1920s, which is something you never hear about, right? You never hear about that. Why do you never hear about that? That's a question worth asking. You know, it was an absolute catastrophe. So these people were starving, right to the point of cannibalism, right? I mean, it was ugly as anything you could possibly imagine. If you were a mother, and so you're supposed to hand all your grain into the Central Committee, mostly for distribution into the cities. You didn't get to keep any for yourself. And so maybe then afterwards, if you were a mother, you'd go out in the fields that had already been harvested, and you'd pick up individual grains of wheat, and if you didn't turn those in, that was death for you. So that's how far it was pushed. So that's a little story about how the idea of victimization and perpetration can get out of hand extraordinarily rapidly. And so whenever people are beating the victim drum, you know, they'll cover that up with empathy, roughly speaking. We're speaking on behalf of the oppressed. It's like, maybe you are, but maybe you're no saint, because, you know, you're so sure that you're a saint and you're only speaking from the position of good. It's highly unlikely.
Something to think about. There are victims. We've all been victims. I've never met a person in my life that at some point was not hurt or had something done to them or said about them that was beyond their control. And some are more egregious than others. But what happens when we become an entire society as a victim culture? And what about a whole generation feeling that they are a victim generation? Then what is the response? Because once you start to push back, if you're pushing back through raw rage, that's where people get hurt and killed. And that's when there is no respect for the other person's life, whether they were responsible or not, for your particular and individual suffering. There has to be more reasoned minds that look at a problem and ask, how can we resolve this? How can we change the underlying circumstances that led to this crisis without destroying other people in the process and being very self-righteous about it? And we're really close to that today. We're at a tipping point. If we're not very careful, we're going to tip. Also, I have this question, and I'd like to see if, I don't know if anyone's listening now, if you're a police officer or you're immediately related to one, there's some information that I just came across that I found interesting. And a friend of mine sent this, and here's what it says. Quote, the average lifespan of a U.S. police officer is only 57 years, or 22 years less than the average population. Quote, an officer who lived in the beginning of age 50 during the period 1950 to 2005 was expected to live only 7.8 additional years, while a U.S. white male for the same period was expected to live an additional 35 years. On average, the life expectancy of white male police officers in our sample was significantly lower than the U.S. white male population. The mean difference was 21.9 years. Wow. And, of course, one of the leading causes of death is suicide. So imagine today when we have clearly, unequivocally, some police who shouldn't be police, and we have training that is inappropriate training, and we're training many of our police in Israel, where they have one of the worst records in the world for dealing with the Palestinians, and they're training U.S. police to act as if everyone they stop and everyone they encounter would be a terrorist Palestinian, as if every Palestinian is a terrorist, which is not the case. And so then on top of that, we're hiring people who are combat veterans who also suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and others who are just psychologically unfit, but they're getting into the system. And then you have unions that protect them and have for decades. And then you have the silence of the blue wall. Just like with medical doctors, you have the white wall, and then you have the nurses protecting nurses, nurses protecting doctors. Now, this is not the majority. There are 800,000 police officers, more or less, in the United States. There is no accurate number of how many shouldn't be police officers, but let's just say, for argument's sake, it's 5%. But when you are saying, what do we want? Dead cops. When do we want them? Now. You're condemning all 800,000. And by extension, their families. Their families, many of their kids, are in school with many of the protesters saying this. The energy you bring home at the end of the day is the energy you were confronted with during that day. You become the energy of your environment. That's what epigenetics means. Larger the environment you're in and everyone in it and your genes. So here is one of the most remarkable findings, that the police are dying faster than any other group in America. And now, with all that we know that could extend the lifespan to at least a healthy 100 years, they're lucky to make it half that, and it's going down rapidly. Is this the best way to approach change? Change is needed. But we need a complete change, not just an episodic change. We need to look deeper. We need to look at the entire justice system. We need to look at how it is controlling everything. For example, everything about laws that we have, most of our laws should be abolished because we didn't look at the time in which laws were passed. Like, for example, look at the people who are now being affected, like Julian Assange, by the Espionage Act from, 1917? And look at the way laws are used for political reasons against people who have a political point of view. We have political prisoners in the United States, thousands of them, and there are going to be a lot more based upon what happens when, and I predict that Democrats will sweep, not just the White House. And in a regular election, that's fine. I don't care who's in office. The people I want to be in office, third-party people like Jill Stein, Ralph Nader, Rocky Anderson, they'll never get into office, but that's okay. But the trouble is everyone is captured in Washington. Everybody is beholding to someone else. Everybody has to do what they're told and can't do what they should do. That's the simple reality, and we refuse to acknowledge that. If you go to Mexico today, no, better still, if you go to Colombia, Colombia is right up at the north, northwest section of South America. And you ask the farmer growing coca leaves, they'll tell you that they make about $35 a day, where normal salaries are $30 a month for the farmers. That's just picking the leaves. And they get very little money. I mean, like, 1,000 pesos, which is nothing, per bag. But then if they process it, if they pour gasoline into drums and other chemicals, and they get it into a paste, well, then they make double that. Okay, then they give that paste to a cartel member who then processes with more chemicals, and then it goes into a brick form, and then it goes to distributors, and then there's dozens of steps before it finally ends up in the United States. Now, you don't see the war, you don't see the war on drugs being won because it's too profitable for everyone engaged. Whole agencies have become permanent, like the DEA, our for-profit prison system benefits, all of the career opportunist prosecutors, which are most, benefit. Everybody has something to gain by continuing American addiction. So why aren't we having national discussions of why we're such an addictive nation? We won't have that discussion. It will be off the table. Why don't we have a discussion about how we can help people retrieve their lives who no longer want to be addicted? We won't do that. Why can't we pardon everyone who's in jail for using drugs? We won't do that. You see, all the solutions are right in front of you, and like Occam's razor, go right, cut through the fat and get to the issue. We won't deal with it, not because we can't intellectually understand it, but just like the war on cancer, and the war on AIDS, and the war on poverty, none of these have ever worked. None of them. None of our wars work. But we won't learn from it because it's too profitable. So when I look at a problem like a cop killing a person who should not have had to die, been treated that way, I see multiple problems manifesting in this person's death, as other deaths have occurred as well. So locking that one cop up is not going to change the system at all. Protecting a cop, has been happening in the past, who's committed a crime, is not going to help anything. It's just going to enrage people. Changing the entire way policing is taught, having everyone go back and take new courses in how to deal with problems is the way that we should do it. Changing the system is how we should do it. Just like aliens coming into the United States, we should have an open policy providing that they get in line and not to pay money. They don't have money to begin with. And frequently they don't have money because of circumstances that we help participate in exploiting their natural resources in Honduras, in El Salvador, in Ecuador, etc. But let them come in, but then have free schools for them at the border. Have humane housing at the border. Have medical attention at the border. Have people work with them to try to find them jobs. We're talking about thousands of people who would be hired at a living wage, who would then work with people coming here who would then assimilate in as constructive citizens. But we wouldn't do that. It's just too obvious that it makes sense. So you can't show me a problem, I can't give you a positive solution. But it's the politics and it's the agenda that prevents them from being implemented. And that's our problem here today. So should we not have a different way of approaching changing the culture within police where you do not denigrate, do not attack them like that idiot attacked the police yesterday and hit him in the head? That's criminal. That's not how you resolve an issue. That's polarizing. So this is what I want to, you know, see is done. But I want to hear from you. If you're a family member or a police officer, call in now, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear your story of what it's like being you now or a family member, and you're being taunted, you're being ridiculed, they want you dead. And what would it be if suddenly we decided it wasn't the police that we were angry at today, but it was rabbis? So we started going in front of every synagogue and saying, what we want, dead rabbis. We want them now. And then hurl stones. What do you think that would happen? What would be the outcome? What if you did it to Muslim clerics, even the most peaceful, loving ones that teach how to assimilate with other cultures and other religions in a loving way and not a violent way? What do you think would be the outcome? Or what if we did it with professors? We don't want any professors. The only professor we want is a dead professor. We want them now. You see, think well before you say something. There's going to be a consequence. Even if it's a silent response, it is not silent in the emotion. And I'm very concerned when we start making chants that are death threats, when we have no longer any spiritual value in another human being. What does that say about us, that we sit quietly? A Dr. Coles, who is a physician, and he is writing a tremendous amount of literature showing that the actual scientific studies are proving that we do not have an actual scientifically accurate universal antibody test, whether it's the polymerase chain reaction or the serological test. And so we should start to pay attention to this. All right? We must start to pay attention to this. So they're giving us tests, which means that more people are testing positive. And that's fine, because the people testing positive who are healthier or younger, especially children, they're not dying and they're not getting sick. And frequently they didn't even know they had the virus in their body. But they're conflating how many new people are showing infection versus death statistics, and they're also continuing to conflate heart disease, cancer, emphysema. So if you're dying of those and you happen to test positive for COVID, they're saying it was COVID that caused the death, and that's simply not the case. And I think that that's important that we understand that. Also, this is really concerning. This is a quote. We are not receiving the necessary cooperation when we contact those who are positive for COVID-19 or those who have been at some of these gatherings. So what they're doing, New York County issued subpoenas to people refusing to talk to contact tracers. Quote, many do not answer their cell phones and do not call back. Sometimes parents answer for their adult children and promise that they have been home consistently when they have not been. This must stop. Well, how do you know that someone's been someplace? They're tracking every single move. Wherever you go with your cell phone, they're following it. Is that what you want? Do you want to have someone who knows every single thing you do during a day, every single keystroke on a computer, what you've written, everything you say over a telephone? Because that's what they're doing. And all those smart home devices, they're watching and listening to everything that goes on in your house. And people are clueless about this. So now they want to subpoena people to see, did you go to a party? But they're not subpoenaing people who went to demonstrations. Isn't that interesting? Millions of people demonstrated, close together, packed. Okay, good. I support the demonstration. Peaceful demonstrations, yes. But that was probably the greatest single reason that most people ended up becoming positive. Now, most are going to overcome that with no symptoms. But now, it's very selective what they can do. But when they start subpoenaing you and you live in New York State, let me tell you, here's the sad story. For those of us who appreciate and love the culture, the uniqueness, the diversity of people, and now what do we see in New York? We see a totalitarian regime, both in the mayor and the governor, a corrupt Congress, the Assembly, the Senate up in Albany, the high cost of living there for rent. That is something that has made New York, in my opinion, uninhabitable. So I suggest that you start to look for the next place to live that is more habitable, more cost, less expensive, and with better communications, without all of the excessive regulation, and with progressive people. And there are a lot of those around. If you go to the webinar, I did a six-hour webinar. I spent a year getting you up to date on every single place that you could go and live for far less and still have the advantages of being in a city, because all the advantages that once were there are no longer there. And it's becoming a dangerous place. That's unfortunate, because it was, in my opinion, the greatest city. But we'll continue. We're going to continue to look at some of our crises, because if we don't have a more open and honest communication What's supposed to get better? How are things supposed to change about your health? And by the way, I got a call from Lou Panessi today, and she said a lot of people are interested in coming down to the retreat. And good for you. We look forward to seeing you there. That'll be the last 2 weeks of October. And we're doing two projects simultaneously. One is a two-week anti-aging study. It is the same identical study we did before, but our goal is to see, can we put everything in 2 weeks that before took 2 months? And it's from 35 to 65 years of age. And then we're doing just a normal health retreat where you come and you enjoy lectures and counseling and good workshops and yoga, meditation, and sprouting. And you'll see the new hydroponic houses and how we're making all these wonderful foods. And it'll be a great experience. And it's completely safe. We follow strict hygiene protocols and did not encumber anything we were doing outside. You know, you don't have to wear a mask when you're not around people. Inside, we do. But we space in the dining room. But you talk about de-stressing and rejuvenating and reinvigorating. Yeah, that we do. So if you want to be a part of that, you can call Luann. And Luann's number is 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008, and it's going to be a wonderful time, and we always fill up. So if you want to join us, let us know now. Have a nice day, everyone.